what Brooklyn sounds like.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Yeah, and I'm Dr. Lisa. I give a shit. I give a shit about you. We all need this right now, right? Because you know what I think's going on out there? I think we're getting to the end of winter. It's been like I'm like, fuck. It hasn't really been winter, but I'm tired of gray, cold shit. So, yeah, let's all bond on that, okay? Okay, it's gonna get warm soon. It's very exciting. It's March. I want to thank you for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. As you may or may not know, I'm a completely untrained therapist. I've been doing this long enough, though, that I have done plenty. I have more experience. I have more clients than anybody, than any real therapist. So, but please go to RadioFreeBrooklyn.org. And check us out, okay? We have a lot of merchandise. We have over 70 shows, every kind of show you can imagine. And we also donate money. Donate money, you know, get ready for tax season. That's next year. So, but donate this year. Anyway, I think I'm a little intimidated. I'm a little intimidated. I just got to put that out there. Okay. I got to put that out there. That's my own doing. I've got like authority issues, counter transference. So I'm just going to put that out there. But I have this really, super talented, super driven. I'm going to say organized. That's probably why it's the organ. Like I picture, this is what's happening. I'm picturing myself working for this guy and not doing a good job and him criticizing me. That's my counter transference, and that's why I'm nervous. But let me just tell you a little bit about him what I don't even know. I mean, this is live. This is the first time we've met. But I am really hugely impressed and a big fan of the Brooklyn Comedy Collective, which he's the founder and director of. And it's been kind of a little bit, you know, I've taken interest in comedy over the last over 10 years, you know, occasionally. But this place is really, really, really different. And it's the vibe. And I'm going to assume that the vibe is coming from Philip Markel, my guest. But I also really want to give a shout out to the teacher that I'm taking. This is the second time I've taken this class with Shalewa Sharp. And there's something really fabulous about her as a teacher. So I'm just saying, like, my experience has been exemplary. And I've done a lot of different comedy classes. And I've been to a lot of the shows are great. The place is a great place to see shows. And the website is well, it's at 167 Graham. I'm gonna tell you know what I'm gonna do? Hi, Philip. Will you tell us about the Brooklyn Comedy Collective? And then I'm gonna say a little bit about you so people know who you are before I start talking to you. Okay, promote the Brooklyn Comedy Collective for me, please. Thank you.
Gladly. And hi, Dr. Lisa. Thank you for having me. So the BCC, or the Brooklyn Comedy Collective, it's an alt theater in East Williamsburg. We reopened there after lockdowns, but we now offer classes and shows Tuesday to Sunday nights on two floors there at the venue. It's called Aris. And then we have two classroom spaces, which, you know, because it's just a barnyard of comedy, one's called the Doghouse and one's called the Pig Pen.
Barnyard.
It's a barnyard of comedy all within 2 minutes of each other. And, you know, people are just casually calling it Chuckle Square now because there's just all this comedy and learning happening right there. But yeah, the vibes aren't just set by me. It's a collective in that, like, it really is built on the love and support and hard work of hundreds of people that give a shit about it. And I like some of the vibes are like, nobody's cooler than anybody else. We're all just freaks and weirdos doing this weird thing in Brooklyn. And to really find your voice and what makes you unique, what can you say in your own way that no one said before. And we have this phrase, fuck it, love it, which is like, fuck it, because we're not going to pretend like comedy is this thing we have to put on a golden calf or a pedestal. Fuck it, we're just fucking around. And then love it, because we don't want to be assholes that are like, fuck you, we just do whatever we want. We love this thing, we love each other. And so the fuck it, love it is like the yin yang way of describing the vibe.
There you go. I really like that. Also, it's pretty evenly split between stand-up and improv.
And sketch. And then we have musical improv. We have clown, okay, taught by Tali Madel. So we're hitting a lot of... And one-man shows and storytelling, too. So,
well, there you go, folks. Yeah. So don't, like, get it in your head, oh, it's, you know, just stand-up, because it's everything. And yeah, a mishmash of all of that. So anyway, I honestly can't... I mean, I'm a very satisfied customer.
Woohoo.
But let me tell you a little bit about Philip. So Philip is, I would categorize him as an overachiever, except he's really multi-talented. So Philip is, really good at a lot of things. He's really good at writing. He's really good at singing. He's really good at writing music, long form, pilots, TV pilots. He's done it all. And he, has performed and taught students internationally from Berlin to Bali. He graduated from Northwestern University, which is a really good school, and he trained in improv in Chicago at the Annoyance. Like, you know how I am, guys. You know, I'm just going to go through it like this. Director for 4 years. So now he's a founding artist at Brooklyn Comedy Collective. Hot... You know what? There's so much stuff. Do your own fucking research, okay? You know what? There's just... Philip is an incredibly multi-talented performer. And just go and look at... And writer. And go and look at philipmarkle.com and then follow him on social media at Philip Sparkle. That's one L in Philip. Okay, that's it.
Yeah, people that have two L's, I'm like, are you trying to give everyone a seizure? I-L-L-I? It's too much. Very grateful my parents just did the one L.
Yeah. Oh, that is my husband's name is Philip.
Is it his last name?
No.
His first name.
Yeah, with two L's. But I still, honestly, I call him Phil and I got it confused. So.
Yeah, my email is just Phil Markle, because no one could ever figure out which one it was. But I guess your husband and I have to fight now. You mean there's no other resolution. We just got
to
come
I don't
to blows.
Know. Well, you're much more of a... Do people call you Philip?
It's truly audience choice. It can be Philip, Phil, Sparkle, Markle, Pip. When I went to college, I insanely decided to rebrand myself as Pip. So for the first semester, I went around and literally told everyone, hi, I'm Pip. And then that lasted about 3 months before everyone, including me, realized that was insane. And so I went back to Philip.
Pip. Yeah, Philip. I'm happy with Philip. You look like a Philip. Like,
yeah. So yeah, Philip, and then I guess I go to Burning Man. I've been to Burning Man a bunch, and there my name is Pip as well. It's like my playa name.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, Burning Man seems like all bets are off to me. So. And no one remembers anything I went through. But anyway, so so I'm going to make assumptions about you, and then we're going to find out. So, Let's do that. And then we'll do, this is, so I think that, you're a really high achiever, I think. I think that you've been like a really great student. I did my research, guys. You were brought up as strictly Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story on your Medium, about you coming out in, when you were 12?
No, it was senior year, and it was after a four-day silent retreat with the Jesuits, a Jesuit silent retreat called Kairos. And the fourth day, you're supposed to live the fourth. And I, because, again, I'm insane, got up in front of my high school senior class after the homily. We were like, they're like, okay, anyone want to give reflections on the experience? And I got up there and I said, Jesus would want me to tell you all right now that I'm gay. I mean, talk about a messiah complex, like me saying Jesus, talking about Jesus in my own lips through me. And then that was followed by like the greatest silence I've ever heard in my life. And then some like slow claps and shuffling and weirdness. And then the priest taking me aside afterwards, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, we're so excited for this discovery you've had about yourself, and we can't wait to teach you about the power of lifelong celibacy as a gay Catholic. And I was like, okay, girl, like this is pretty manipulative.
You can't say celibacy to a teenage boy ever.
No, I just come out. And then, you know, the coming out experience was like one of those highs that like, you know, a true moment of being fully in who I was. Not only as like a Leo Moon performer and doing it in the most public way possible, but in just taking a huge risk to say something I'd never said before. And then, you know, that was amazing. And then it was complicated after that, you know?
Right, right, right. And you also came out to your mother and she accepted you, but then she followed up by giving you conversion pamphlets. So what I'm seeing is somebody who really believed in the adults around them and what they were being told, and then was betrayed by two of your major authority figures.
Well, I betrayed is like a strong word. My dad is now fully accepting, and you know, saw me at Joe's Pub singing a song called "Gay Bathhouse."
I heard,
you know, "Gay Bathhouse," and my poor dad just like staring at me, talking about, you know, being fucked in a sling. And so he's like,
"I love it,"
you know. So like, he's cool with it, even if it's not his necessary cup of tea. And he took his time with it. And my mom, it was a lot more complicated. I think she got a lot of bad advice from the priest she went to, and the community did not support her wanting. She always said she loved me, but she couldn't love, you know, love the sin, love the sinner, right. Hate the sin.
Right.
And so it was really, really awful. And it got better over time. You know, she wrote me a note saying that she accepted me and my sexuality. She gave me that note. And then she passed away on my birthday. And it was like this crazy wow. sort of bridge that had been, you know, mostly met, but had never been fully healed. And so that was a hard
And it
thing.
Was really sudden when she passed,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit?
It just happened the night of my birthday. I mean, talk about workaholicism. I just committed to cleaning my entire room and apartment, taking a bubble bath, turning off my phone, being like, I'm going to start 27, year of heaven, like just really, you know, start fresh. And then I woke up the next day to that nightmare of like, you know, 50 missed calls and the hell of just, you know, she had accidentally overdosed overnight. And, you know, it was.
She overdosed because she was a doctor, right? I want people to understand.
Yeah. And I think it's public enough. I don't want to speak to it too specifically,
yeah.
But yeah, she had just, you know, the danger of self-medicating, and accidents mm-hmm. that can happen that way.
But it wasn't like an addiction. That's
no,
what I kind of
no.
want to make clear, I think.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. So, and when I say betrayal, I don't mean that actually the people personally betrayed you. What I mean is that you did the you did in my mind, I'm going to say an incredibly brave, daring, and quote unquote righteous,
mm-hmm.
righteous thing. And the feeling I'm getting perhaps is that like the priests wanted to honor it. They wanted to accept you. In a way.
In a limited way.
In
yeah.
a way, like their first instinct, they both knew, your mother and the priest.
Yeah.
The right thing to do is this guy. But then they couldn't handle it on their own, in their own way, right?
Or in their own dogma. You know, what we run up against with like, this is what the greater organization says, you know, and coming out back then, this was 2004. It was a scarier time. Like there was what, Will and Grace on television. There wasn't a lot of open queerness. And so I think, you know, my parents had just both voted against gay marriage in California when
really?
That Prop 8 came up. So, you know, it was just a different time. And I'm so happy that things today, you know, some gays are like, you know, well, we suffered, you know, kids today have it so easy. They can just call them, you know, go, you know, discover themselves, whatever. And there's no risk. And I'm like, that's what I would have loved. You know, yes, this was a brave, crazy thing to do. But I'm so happy the world has moved on and that people can change over time. And I think my mom was changing mm-hmm. in the way that I see my dad has changed. And that's when you just get to know someone as a human being and some right. seeing their human vulnerability. You can't help but be moved if you're not weighed down by like the dogma of the Catholic Church or something like that.
Right. So how are you brought up? I mean, did you have brothers or sisters? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up north of San Francisco. I went to a Catholic school in the city, so I always just say I'm from San Francisco because I was there when it was cool, before it's all techie, blah, blah, blah. I had a really great experience in San Francisco. And then I have a younger sister who just had a kid, so I'm a gunkle. I'm seeing the whole...
A gunkle. That's a new word for me. I love it.
A gunkle. I'm seeing Isabel on Sunday. I'm going to go fly out to Pittsburgh and help them. And yeah. And so my sister and I, we were 3.5 years apart. We were always kind of in different fields doing our different things. But it's just, you know, as we've gotten older, we've gotten closer and closer. And I'm really, really happy for them. And they're living like the family life. They have a house in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh's great.
Yeah. I love that. I don't know why Pittsburgh should be a thing. You know?
Yeah, right.
Where you going? Pittsburgh, honey. I go to a gay festival called Honcho outside Pittsburgh, and it's like queer utopia run by Pittsburgh gays, and I love it.
Oh yeah. So you grew up, I'm going to say it's a suburb then of San Francisco?
In Marin County, yeah.
Marin County.
Up on a hill, yeah.
And what did your parents do?
My dad's an accountant, and my mom was a doctor, so neither of them performers. Don't know where that came out in me. But on like the business side of running the BCC, I totally think I get that from like my dad. And I've always had like the business brain and the creative brain and the fight, the war that they go on with each other to both be expressed. I get pleasure in different ways out of both of them. I think at times the business brain can be overwhelming and take up the creative room and the space and the air you need to come up with creativity. So that's always a challenge. But yeah, I get that from my dad for sure, I think.
And you're so, you know, you're really driven. Were your parents driven or?
Yeah. My mom was one of the first female doctors to come out of Notre Dame.
Oh, my God.
She was incredible. She started her own practice after working at Kaiser.
Wow.
My dad started his own business. Yeah, my mom was incredibly brave, like starting, you know, it was, again, a different time. And she was like, what do you mean women can't be doctors? Fuck you. So she did her own thing.
She sounds like such a great example.
Yeah.
It sounds like she gave you a lot of that. I don't want to call it courage because I don't think it's courage. I think it's really more natural for you, but you're like the person who's going to speak up.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I think before I came out, a lot of it was trying to be the perfect son and, you know, overachieve and all that. And then when I came out, it was like, well, this is the deepest part of me. And it got really hard when like the deepest part of me wasn't embraced, but all the golden child star, you know, you're doing this, you're going to college. Like, you know, like all of that was celebrated, but the core of me felt very, unseen. And so it then became a mission for me on stage, at least. I went to school for theater and did a couple plays after college. And, you know, you go from doing great work in a class in college to doing whatever garbage you can get cast in as a new actor in Chicago.
Absolutely.
And so I was like in these things that were, I found pretty unfulfilling. And I was like, you know what? I'm actually bored by this, doing the same show that I don't like 8 times a week. I want to write. I want to create. And that's how I got into comedy. And that's how I tried to become a gay wizard on stage, to bring back the whimsy, that, you know, authentic, earnest, unironic, big, hit the pedal on the gas feeling. And then my show Sparkle Hour, which I still do every like third Saturday at BCC, is like gay church. It's a celebration. It's wacky and ridiculous, and I have amazing queer guests. And then I always end with a moment of vulnerability, because once you've earned the audience's trust, that way you can be real in a way and just say what's going on with you right now. And then, you know, end on a big musical number or something, because, you know, leave them with a little earworm.
So there's so that's great that you can create a platform where you feel safe. So do you think that what happened to you at the retreat that seems like it must have been a really life-changing, is that as profound as I think it is? It sounds to me that like it's kind of like a real boom moment where you were like, hey, this is who I am. And then like you weren't prepared for the way that it was received.
Yeah, and some people were so welcoming. So I made deeper friendships with my high school friends who now saw me fully as I was. I kind of became the most popular kid in school for, I don't know, 4 days. Everyone was talking about it.
I bet.
This psycho did this. And then, yeah, like, That was after 4 days of not talking, right?
Yeah.
It was a 4-day silent retreat. And yeah. So I just told you I came back from this trip upstate with my dog Star, who I'm obsessed with. And we just spent 4 days in a cabin doing nothing. And I find that like being the busy, busy bee, it's like you don't actually have moments of revelation so much unless you give them space. I did DJ for the first time last night and had a crowd of strangers dancing to my soul disco house. I'd never done that before. That was nascent. That was new. And that was like a drug. But as far as like, you know, how am I growing as a person? I believe in therapy. I believe in doing, you know, oodles of ketamine and tripping out and psychedelics and exploring it. But you need space to do that. And especially with our phones and the way that I feel like I have to constantly be on, reply to things right away. It's such a curse. And I really miss the pre-internet generation where like you had to call yeah. somebody's landline and there was just space to do nothing. And that was the pace of life. I so miss that.
I want to read all the different kinds of therapy that you've done besides ketamine, which you're kind of famous for, I understand.
Yeah, I wrote a little Medium article that was really personal called Ring Around the Neuroses, a catchy phrase. And it got picked up by AFP News, which is on Yahoo, but even it was published in Indonesia. And they took this like actually pretty hot photo of me with a bag of ketamine on my table.
Which you can buy for $450 from Getty.
I guess, yeah. And I talked about them, about my experience and what it was. And now everyone's talking about ketamine therapy. And I'm not here to say like, you know, obviously drug usage should always be moderated and responsible and under the care and supervision. But for me, it was at least temporarily like, it was a nice reset of like clearing all the bullshit that I thought was important to me to be like, oh yeah, I'm a human being. What's really important to me?
Well, as a hobbyist therapist, I could really learn a lot from you. I mean, we could do a whole session on you teaching me about therapy, but because you started talk therapy when you were 12, you've been on prescription antidepressants, all different ones. Are you on any now? I am.
Yeah, I'm on this Wellbutrin.
Oh,
she's
this
nice.
This must be really good.
I like her the best.
People like that.
Yeah.
Acid, of course. MDMA, ayahuasca. You smoked the toad twice.
Oh yeah, I did. That's like
that's
the nuclear bomb
deal.
Of psychedelics.
Very rare.
Yeah, I the first time was pretty revelatory. The second time, I think too much. I really experienced my own death. Like I died. I felt Philip Markle evaporate into a static television screen of the universe. And it was pretty terrifying. maybe good for long term. You know, I've got a little taste of what it's like to fade away. But yeah, that's very intense.
And then following a duck on mushrooms. Mushrooms.
Oh, yeah. I was in Amsterdam. I was in there. I got some mushrooms and I did a lot and I was sort of freaking out. And so I just saw this duck in the Vondelpark or whatever it's called. And I was like, you know what? Just follow this duck. And I just got out of my bullshit. I'm like, I'm just going to watch and follow this duck. And it calmed my trip down by just following a duck for an hour.
Wow.
Whatever the duck did, I went with it.
That's very good resources. Good resources. That's why you can handle all this shit. Healers with psychic dogs, lucid dreaming. There's too many.
Yeah.
Let me just give you an idea, guys. So lucid dreaming, philosophy from Aristotle, meditation retreats, Burning Man, realistic mystics, magical thinking in Korean spas, timeline therapy, 3-week stint in Bali.
Yeah, I went to
so
Bali.
you've been to a lot of different kinds of therapy. Are you in therapy now?
Yeah, I've been doing EMDR, which was a new thing for me, and I like the eye stimulation. Yeah. It sort of hits your brain in a different way. Because I feel with talk therapy, I got to the point where I could just talk about my problems forever or about behaviors, but the behaviors didn't change so much. I was just repeating ad nauseum and getting pretty frustrated that I was talking about the same shit that I had come in with 3 years before, even though I felt like really comfortable with my therapist. So more active therapies like that have been pretty cool.
You're an action-oriented person.
Yep.
And therapy is pretty passive, talk therapy.
I wrote a poem once. I still remember it. It's, I am a doer. I do all the time. And it goes on and on about how, like, I wish I could just be, but being's not what I can do. So I do this, do that, do him, do her. And it's just this, it's kind of the way I've always been, and I've always tried to change it, but it doesn't really change.
It's your nature.
Yeah.
It seems like it's got a lot of physical. It's a very physical part of your physicality, right?
Oh, I like to walk fast. I've gotten much more into working out in my body and like feeling good about that. Well, COVID was like a big thing where I just sat on the couch for 2 years, put on 15 pounds and, you know, felt pretty awful and was drinking a bottle of wine a night. And, you know,
like the whole rest of the world.
Yeah, it was running a theater at the time, you know, I watched my whole business fall apart, was doing online comedy, which is as bad as it sounds. And it was a really dark moment in my life. I almost walked away. I came very close to just saying, fuck it, I'm done. I'll do something else. This is too hard. It was within an inch. And it was just with the help of Maya Sharma, my associate that has been with the BCC for years now, that got me just over that hump to have the courage to reopen. Open it. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because it's so successful to me now. It's blown up in a way that is so, it's what I always wanted. I started it in 2018, but you know, the fact that I came that close, really that close to walking away. And right before I made that decision, I took a 24-day road trip with my dog in a Mini Cooper from San Francisco to New York, down through San Diego and across. And that cleared my head. Again, the silence, the stillness before making a big call like that.
Well, you know, it's funny. It sounds like when you're so, let's say, you know, motivated that it's, or work, you know, productive, productivity oriented, that when you have downtime, that has to be productive too.
Yeah.
So then you probably go into like a self, self-discovery mode, self-inventory mode when you have time alone.
Yeah. And I feel like, well, carving time, like going to a Korean spa all day in Spa Castle and just sitting there and making the time where I'm honoring the commitment to not check my phone or something is a lot more successful for me than, oh, I'm just going to have a chill night at home. Like I'm not going to be on Instagram the whole fucking night and watching a movie and then pausing it and doing something else. You know, I think this is pretty universal. Our brains have been completely corrupted by technology.
So does somebody like you have time for relationships?
Mm-hmm.
Do you?
I'm dating right now, and it's always been something that, you know, to be completely transparent, like I my longest relationship was like 9 months. And I'm so into new things that like the start of it is always exciting, but then I would find discomfort, or I actually didn't feel like I could always say my discomforts in earlier relationships. And so they would kind of peter out, or I would bail and then like having the time to like really commit to it, it's a struggle. I do feel like I've gotten much more communicative about like I can show anger or frustration to someone and not feel terrified that they're going to reject me. But that's been something that I've had to work on.
Yeah, because you're around people all the time. I mean, you must meet a lot of people. He's really hot, personable, all that stuff. It's definitely like, I don't think there's a dearth. I don't think you have a problem with finding candidates. But I'm wondering, you know, I mean, this is a cliche and I'm not saying I believe it, but the therapist would say that you're avoiding intimacy by being so busy.
Totally. I think there's truth in that. I think, you know, we always do what's most comfortable for us. And for whatever reason, being a hyperactive workaholic has become something that I at least get dopamine hits from, you know? But if you ask me after ketamine or some clearing or some stillness, what's important to me, it would be the former, of like finding that deep connection. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I do. I know a lot of people. And as I think when I was first doing comedy or starting out, I wanted to know and be friends with as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. I wanted that width. And now all I care about is depth. And really managing, like, my friendships are so important to me. I have so many ride or die girls in various friend groups that like mean so much to me. And I would just like that, you know, I have that with my dog. We're ride or die. I've saved her life 5 times now, literally.
Wow, really?
Oh,
wow.
Star's always trying to escape this mortal coil. She had cancer as a puppy when I adopted her. Oh yeah, they fucked up. They gave me her as a 1-year-old and didn't tell me she had cancer. So I adopted a dog with cancer, got her removed twice, took her then to a Brooklyn dog nutritionist who was like a witch. She had this thick accent. She was like, you know, we got to figure out why your dog's blowing cancer. And she just like did this diet, and Stars never had cancer again.
Really?
But she did eat enough rat poison to kill her 4 times over on the road trip. in San Diego, had to pump her stomach. And then, you know, she's almost been mauled to death by dogs. And if you want to ask me, would I pick up my dog over my head and kick off dogs trying to kill her? The answer is yes. I have done that and I would do that.
Uh-huh. This is a very expensive animal.
Girl, she cost me everything, but she's giving me so much. I love my baby.
No. I bet you are a really good friend. I get the feeling. I mean, I definitely. You probably work as hard as your friendships as everything else. But I am going to be this is really, I feel obnoxious saying this, but you know, I'm obnoxious, I guess. I'm going to say that you changed the topic when I asked you, about intimate relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that annoying that I said that? I'm sorry.
No, I can't. It's pretty hard to phase me. You can call me out on my bullshit if you feel like I'm bullshitting or avoiding it.
I don't know anything. I don't mean to like sound like I have training because I don't. But I'm just wondering if you really is it that you don't have long-term relationships because you really don't want them, or are you really like your life is busy and full. Like how much do you really want them?
I'm tired of being alone. In the space of when I'm not around friends and comedy and community, mm-hmm. I'm tired of carrying all this myself. And what I really want is to be with someone that can share my life and I share his life. And I mean, that's what I'm really. If you asked me, like, was I ready for that? I would say, like, even 2 years ago, I was not. It was especially mm-hmm. during the pandemic. A lot of people fell in love in the pandemic, and I didn't have sex for 2 years. I was, like, terrified. You know, that's an exaggeration. It's not
well,
totally
although a
true,
lot of
but
people, yeah,
it was pretty dry.
Yeah.
But now, like, it's priorities, right? Like, in my therapy yesterday, I was like, I have to stop micromanaging. I have to create boundaries. I have to just turn the email off because it's just come to the point where, like, whatever dopamine or thrill I get out of that, it is coming at the expense of my whole being and it's exhausting me. And I'm not 27 anymore. I can't just do that and then go out to 4 a.m. and be like, no problem. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to make room and I'm moving the relationship in terms of priorities higher. And it's hard because my schedule, I showed you the calendar, it's just nuts
no,
right now.
No. I mean, you're totally like, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. You could do anything, really, I think, with the bit talent and drive you have. I don't know why you chose something that this hard.
Well, the answer as an artist was like, we talked about this too, is that like when you're an artist, you can feel powerless. Like you're waiting for in this business, yes. like a golden goose to be like you and yeah. right time, right place. And you're ready for it and your material is good to go. And so like the idea, I know I have friends that like moved to LA and are doing little to nothing and just waiting for something to happen. That's my hell.
Yeah.
You know, that's what would make me, I think, crazy. So building a business and a platform, not only for myself, but for lots of people I care about. And I walk in and I get this like secondary joy yeah. of seeing, you know, people don't even know me. I'm just yeah. watching their show or the open mic. And it's like that gave me some stability in an otherwise chaotic universe. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that maybe you're, and I understand that the gatekeepers, the drive to have creative control over your own product and your own opportunities. I mean, 100%. And this is, I think, ultimately, honestly, when I'm thinking about it now, what I really, really, one of the things that I really mostly respect about you is that you made it happen in such a major way on your own. It's very impressive because a lot of creative people complain about that they don't get opportunities. You know, I mean, I've gone out and done a bunch of guerrilla things and stuff like that, but the idea of actually making a formal situation for yourself and other people to do it, not like one-off guerrilla thing, is very, very impressive. So I'm wondering now that this is really, and I noticed from living in the neighborhood how it really took off after the pandemic, mm-hmm. right? And it's grown. I can see it in my neighborhood. And so do you think that maybe you're getting to the point now where you've satisfied that need?
Yeah. And look, the job of every owner of a business is to be replaced, to replace yourself, right? And so there are like upwards of 20 employees now that work at BCC. Wow. So, you know, they're handing it off and trusting and letting go. That's my new thing that I'm working on, to be less, you know, actively doing or managing or micromanaging or looking at everything myself, and to trust and let go so that I do have room in my life for whether it's new things like more time spending on relationships, or like I said, like DJing last night. It felt like the first comedy show I've ever done. It was so thrilling.
Oh, wow.
To, on a real, you know, pioneer system, to spin for strangers I didn't know and to see what was working and what was not. And it was a beginner's mind, you know.
Wow.
It was so exciting. So I was like, yeah, I want to make room in my life for that newness.
What venue, if I can ask?
At the theater, at Aris, where we do all our shows. So it was in our home backyard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And a shout out to Aris. You know, they've hosted the BCC. The relationship is symbiotic. So I basically knocked on their door one day. I was like, yo, what happens in here before 10 p.m.? And because they're a nightclub, right? And they were like, well, not much really. And so we basically do comedy there Tuesday to Sundays till 10. And then they take over with late night programming and dance parties and... It's a symbiotic relationship where, like, you know, we can share, collectively share the use of a space and to make it all.
That's really
And it's
smart.
Perfect. They have a huge main stage, big, like, Burning Man ran into off-Broadway and had a freak child baby, and then this, like, murder dungeon improv basement. And they're both so cool. And again, everything's a minute away between that and
I
the
remember
classrooms.
The first time I walked in there, guys, I was really surprised. I was like, this little... Yeah, it was a little comedy place, whatever. And like, this is their theater? Shit. I mean, it puts like UCB to shame by a long shot. The old UCB. Remember that place? Let's not. Never mind. Have you ever participated in UCB?
Yeah, I mean, I took some classes there. And our philosophy to improv is very different from theirs. Not to say like one is right or one is the other. And then like I know they're reopening and I think that's exciting. There was a lot of problematic behavior and tone that they set last time they ran. We pay performers and producers of our shows. We were one of the first comedy theaters to do that because back then everyone just worked for free. And it's not always like a ton of money. They make like 50% of the box.
Doesn't matter.
But it's about saying that there is a value and there is a payment for you helping to bring in audiences with us.
Well, that embodies the word collective, which is so much. I personally am so much more into than the word club.
Yeah, and
I mean, that's a huge difference.
We also make collective decisions. So I learned a long time ago that if I try and make decisions on my own, I'm going to get it wrong. You know, no one gets it right all the time. And I have biases. I have blind spots. Mm-hmm. So between me and Maya Sharma and Julian Hernandez, who are like the triumvirate right now, that run the theater, really, between programming and managing it, and me as the artistic director, any big decision we make collectively. Mm-hmm. And there's transparency around finances and what people make. And like, you know, just like... Why not put three minds to use to make more ethical decisions? Mm-hmm. Even if at the end of the day I'm the owner and I'm financially responsible and have to, you know, shepherd the whole thing. And my name is on the line.
Your name is on the right.
Yeah, but you know, it's I really believe in the power of collective decision making.
Well, good management, you know, and you were saying that you have actually been doing some corporate. Tell us about the stuff that you've been doing with corporate.
Oh, sure. We taught 120 employees at Wasserman yesterday. I had four teachers.
Wasserman
It's like an activation company. They're pretty well known. I mean, we've taught at EY. We've taught a lot of Fortune 500 companies. We taught small ones. We reopened Brooklyn Borough Hall for the Brooklyn Borough President, Antonio Reynoso.
Wow, really?
We're going to do that again for Women's History Month.
Wow.
So we're like doing all these gigs around. And when it comes to like the corporate side, like it's not a comedy class. It's teaching. So what improv did for me, improv made me a more open person, more confident in my own choices, more willing to embrace the weirdness, the freakness, the mistakes, and then to be a better teammate. And so we translate all those skills through improv games and exercises, and we followed this methodology, the methodology that you mentioned earlier about Aristotle called ethos, pathos, logos, which is really getting people to pay attention. Ethos is like the ethics of a person, or basically, what's the vibe? How can you create a vibe where everyone feels like they're seen? Pathos is leading with vulnerability and emotion. And instead of just, you know, making it all about logos, the data, or like the emails, and this is what you need, treating and making people feel heard. And so improv teaches these improv skills. And our workshops, you know, I did a lot of corporate workshops or back in the day with, you know, other companies when I was learning this, that was just like zip, zap, zop and mm-hmm. games, and it meant nothing. Mm-hmm. And so we really care about attaching tangible takeaways, like the fuck it, love it thing I said, or this idea of assuming competence when, you know, I ask, you know, who's nervous about improv? And I'm like, everyone raises their hand. I'm like, that's totally normal. It's public speaking is most people's number one fear, and improv is public speaking without knowing what you're going to say. So run for the doors. You can still escape. But if you can, but assuming competence is like, just pretend you're amazing at this. Instead of being like, I don't think I'm good, just say, I'm a rock star and I'm going to make mistakes and that's how I'm going to learn. And if you can make the fear of failing less than the joy of going for it and trying, it just opens up your whole life and workplace wow. culture.
Wow. But you know, I was thinking that like your way of looking at running your business, probably translates through these workshops to actual corporations, you know, the way they run their business. They probably relate to what you're saying in a way.
Yeah. And I mean, we have amazing teachers that teach this as well. I also share my personal perspective of being a small business owner that, and you know, I ran the Annoyance Theater when it was, that was my mm-hmm. place that really could let my freak flag fly in Chicago. I brought it out to New York. But at the time, you know, I was 28. And so mm-hmm. I made every mistake in the book between mm-hmm. wanting to be everyone's friend and buddy, even though I was running the thing, to, you know, I've just had to learn through trial and error, and I've learned things like never send an angry email if you can. I'm still working on that
one.
Oh, really?
Like, that's good to
just
know.
Just send the email to yourself and sleep on it. Take a Xanax if you have to. Just let it go, and you'll wake up the next morning with different perspective. And 9 out of 10 times, that conversation is going to go so much better in person, following the ethos, pathos, logos thing, because who you are and how you feel can come across before you get to like the difficult thing that you need to share if there's some sort of like difficulty.
Well, that's good advice. I'm going to write that
down.
Don't,
girl. And I still struggle with it. Just don't send the fucking
email.
No, that
makes really good sense. That makes really good sense. So as a goal for yourself, like this is a pretty, I mean, you've established something pretty cool, but as a performer, do you have other goals? Do you have other goals for BCC or like what? I mean, if you were like, this is what I'm seeing in your future, maybe. Like, you got the BCC thing down. Step back a little. Like you say, trust people. And then you'll have time to let somebody into your life. Because you have to take a lot. It's time-consuming and very risky with your time. Like, you have to spend hours with somebody getting to know them and then deciding if you want to keep seeing them. I mean, it's very, like, it's not efficient getting close to somebody is just not efficient. So I'm just wondering if, you know, that if like what, you know, what are you motivated for going further? Is it, you know, stepping back and having time for more people and things or things that you like to do? Or is it, you want to, you know, do you have a performing goal or goal with your business? Just curious.
Well, yeah, now that I'm trying to make more space and time. I mean, on the BCC side, my job is to now see about new things, new opportunities. Like, we partnered with Daniel Kramer, who's a comedy producer, last fall, and did this Pitch Fest festival where people had their pilots selected and then performed for a lot of industry with their favorite talent, with their friends, bringing it to life. So much better than a PDF on a page, you know?
Oh, my God.
And people got real shit out of that, you know? And I got reach outs. I had a pilot in that as well. So BCC can be a platform. It's my home too, and I'm always doing my own shit there, challenging myself as an artist in my shows, getting up and fucking around and improvising, and then creating my Sparkle Hour show on the third Saturday of every month, and then continuing to write, do new things like DJ. That's all the playground.
So you made a playground, and you're happy. I mean, who wouldn't be? That's a great playground.
Yeah, and then on the relationship side, I think it relates to the definition of time I was saying about earlier, about how you're saying it's inefficient. It requires unstructured time too, or it's not like we have 3 hours for a date. It's like the night is just ours and we're going to see where it takes us. And, I'm really excited about more of that.
Yeah. And, so you see like the areas that you want to grow as a performer and a writer, they're all available to you now, really, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, again, this industry is on an individual performer level, it's never fair. You know, mm-hmm. it's not going to be. That's why people can be driven insane mm-hmm. by it. And so you have to, I do my best to remember that I am performing for the joy of creating something from my heart and my imagination yeah. with people I love. That's why I always like to invite friends to play in my shows. And with the DJ set last night, like I'm just doing this for free for fun. It's my first time. Like I'm just giving this gift because it fills me up. And when you attach like, oh, I've got to make it. I need this thing. It puts so much pressure. It's like the fuck it, love it thing of like, the more you want it, the harder it is to enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah. It's a process. I'm always about that. It's a process. Like where I am with comedy right now is like, I'm studying comedy and I do open mics and I've gotten a couple of gigs, but like, I'm just like, I want to go to open mics and do the open mics and write the comedy and do the open mics. And that's fun.
Yeah.
That process is fun. I don't have to worry about anything else. If anything happens, it does, but I don't have to worry. Like I'm not putting pressure on myself. It's the process.
And to that, we get students that are just here for fun. They're like, I'm a lawyer. I want to work on my, you know, just take an improv class, work on my skills. And there are people that are like, I want to be a famous comedian and I want it yesterday. And between the gamut, you know, with the latter, I really just try to get them to enjoy the act of creating for the act itself. Not right. that you don't work hard and that you hustle and that you strive for these things, but right. you know, have Absolutely. The wisdom. What's that quote? The wisdom to know what's in your control, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah, and what you can control, what you can, the wisdom to know the difference. I think that's what it really, I mean, I think because the only thing you have control over is the process. That's what I always say to the kids.
And to make your own opportunities. I always, like, when people are frustrated, I'm like, start your own show. Don't wait for someone to, like, see you. Like, do your own thing and be generous. Give other people opportunities without even expecting a tit for tat, which is hard. I know. I used to be that way. I was just like, well, I put in my show. Why would they put me in their show?
Right. But you can't think
way. But it's poison. It's Absolutely. Poison to
I
think
agree.
That way.
So I agree.
The more generous you are in the way you create and share and make opportunities for other people, the more organically I think it becomes a heart-opening, life-giving experience.
Yeah, and then you're embedded in all the stuff that's out there. What about, I was going to say, so is there a comedian or a performer whose career that you look to and say that's a good career? Or
I mean, one of my friends, Dylan Adler, is taking off crazy right now. And you know, we talk about this business being unfair, but when someone who really deserves it is successful and gets noticed and gets big opportunities, that's the greatest joy. Mm-hmm. And so seeing Dylan shine, he's a writer on James Corden right now.
Oh, wow.
He's, you know, but he also has been doing his own musical comedy. We both love musical comedy.
Oh, yeah.
I met him in a cab shared to the BCC after an open mic with him and his keyboard when he first moved here.
Oh,
and I'll never forget, like, seeing that journey, like, it's inspiring to me. And I'm so happy for him. And I consider him a friend that, like, you know, again, or happened organically over a long period of time of spending unstructured time in the Poconos, fucking around in a cabin, like, you know, hanging out. I don't mean fucking. I mean, just like with friends, like, you know.
We don't care.
And so I'm so happy and I'm admiring him and watching him blossom. It's just very exciting to me, even though I'm, you know, much older than him.
Did you, so were you like a performer kid from day one? What were you like as a kid? I'm trying to picture that.
Oh, yeah. I was in Darn Yankees in fifth grade. You know, couldn't say damn, had to say Darn Yankees. Can you believe that?
It's
so fucking ridiculous. I was always.
So were you always, I mean, you're an extrovert?
I think so.
Were you always like, you know, you always had friends and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, I think when in my closeted, like, I was playing computer games mostly in the first 2 years of high school, and I didn't have a lot of friends, and I was actually living this alternate ego life on as an avatar in the game EverQuest, which is the precursor to World of Warcraft. I played a wizard, and I came out in the game years before I came out in the real world as the pink pansy, and I wore this Flaming pink wizard robe. My name was Ailey Olin on the Prexus server. This is what I wrote my film about, Gamer, because it was about like how I pretended as this wizard to be this fabulous, queer, you know, fantastic wizard, literally. And then in real life, I was this closeted kid who didn't have a lot of friends. And then finally, by pretending to be the wizard after I quit the game, it gave me the courage to be a wizard in that church in real life and, and to cast that spell.
Wow. So were you popular on, the video game, or whatever, the...
I was a very powerful wizard. I sold that character on eBay for $1,000 and it was a buy now and it sold in like a minute. I could have gotten way more. It was like, wow, spent a lot of time
so
on that.
Impressed.
No, it was ever cracked. It was an addiction.
No, but what I'm saying is that you had the nature, you knew what the formula was. I mean, you did it naturally.
Yeah.
Well, whatever mixture you had of characters and whatever it takes, you had that naturally.
Yeah.
That must have given you a lot of confidence, right? And validation about being gay, right?
Yeah. Like trying it out in a chat message, you know, singing songs in a chat. Like I'm sure I know I annoyed a lot of people in my guild, but it was just really, you know, it was
so
special.
You made your own opportunity is what I'm saying. You made your own opportunity to sort of grow up gay a little bit.
Yeah. So anonymously.
You,
yeah.
So what was being gay like? When you were growing up, I mean, I don't really have a sense.
It was very scary. I mean, it wasn't that long after Matthew Shepard and everything. It was like, you know, or Laramie, you know, it was really, I even like emotionally feel like just how scary it was. And I, I'm grateful people don't have that feeling anymore. But like, you know, my mom thought I would get AIDS and I'd never be in a relationship. Aww. You know, like that was the stereotype because there weren't a lot of gay role models other than like this cheeky Will and Grace show where like everyone was typed.
I'll say.
And I even remember once an industry person told me, I'll never forget. He's like, yeah, Phil, you know, I think in this day and age, you really want to be more Will from Will and Grace than Jack. You know what I mean?
Oh,
and it was
wow.
like, God, okay. And this wasn't even that long ago. I was like, girl, we have got to move on. You know, you want to be the freakiest, most expressed version of yourself because that's where you're going to find no one else like you.
Wow. So did people know you were gay? Like were you trying to hide it at school or did people know or?
I think it was a mix. My sister thought I was joking when I came out to her. She couldn't believe it. I mean, she was like 13 and a half, so whatever. But, I think, you know, I was out in college from day one. So there was never a question about it. Had my first like gay moment in what was called the rat trap. Now we got the doghouse, the pig pen. It was the rat trap, the basement in Willard College at Northwestern. And it was this guy just making out. And I was so nervous and naive. And I just, you know, Googled what was gay. And I'll never forget, like we were making out and I just said, are you a top or a bottom? But I didn't mean sex. I literally was so naive. I meant, do you like to kissy kissy like on top or do you want to be like on the bottom of the kiss? Like, you know, who's on top?
Aww.
Like, and he was really turned off. He was like, we're talking about that on the first makeout. And I was like, so ashamed. And Matt Loper, if you're out there, just know what I really meant.
That's so cute.
Yeah, it was cute.
So were you comfortable being gay in college?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
I felt very accepted. I mean, again, back home, it was very tricky, but in college, I felt very accepted.
So there weren't a lot of, like, because you were in a Catholic school.
Not in college. I mean, but
no,
yeah,
and
back
I'm
at
talking
home.
About in like middle school, high school.
Yeah, I mean, I was terrified of anyone knowing I was gay in middle school. I mean, that's why I started therapy really early, as I was really exhibiting signs of unhappiness that my parents didn't know how to deal with because I was closeted and containing all this built up terror and rage and fear of just like, I can't be myself. And so I was in therapy and I'll never forget, my therapist knew. He asked me, he told me, Rick, my therapist, he's like, I have a gay son. And he was like, you know, is that something you've ever thought you might be? And I was like, no.
Oh, really?
But like, he was trying, you know, I think he could tell. And then I had a therapist after that who was a Catholic therapist and encouraged my mom that I was going through a phase, like did damage, which is a number one therapy thing. Like I would want her to have her license revoked for what she did because she really thought it was a phase. And I was like, I just literally came out in front of an entire room of my senior class. Like, no, this is not a phase. And how demeaning and condescending of you to tell my parents that.
So you must have a lot of feelings about the Catholic religion.
Yeah.
Now.
No, thank you. I know there are people that do really good work in the Catholic Church, but as a whole, it's a toxic fucking organization. And they have no business telling anyone about sexuality, given the history and what they've covered up and the sexual abuse that their church has condoned and, you know, supported.
The hypocrisy. They I would imagine
no
that would...
box to stand on.
Yeah.
Thank you, ma'am. The soapbox is not yours anymore. Mm-hmm. You could apologize big time and do a lot of work before anyone should give a shit. And they got to get in the 21st century. It's the 21st, right? Yeah, it's the 21st century.
Last time. Yeah, that's where
time.
We are.
What is it? They're just, you know, they're an old fucking relic. And it reminds me of the conservative backlash that's happening now to gay rights and trans rights across the U.S.
Oh,
and
my
how,
God.
How just like...
And abortion rights.
Yeah. I mean, the regressiveness and it makes me so sad because if these people, again, if you meet someone on a human-to-human level and you don't boil them down to like the stereotype of like, man, everyone's so woke. If you actually heard this person's story or why their pronouns are important to them, you know, at the end of the day, it's like your individual belief more important than their heart, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's the hypocrisy of like saying it's the judgment, it's the hypocrisy. But, you know, on the bright side, I'm going to say, I mean, I've lived in Bushwick for like about 10 years now. And in my world, Bushwick, New York, this area, I feel so much better about human rights, respect for other people. The comedy community is a lot more inclusive.
Right. We were talking when I came up, it was like all white bros. And I was the token gay who would literally sing in every show because I was so upset that like all it was straight bro comedy.
Oh, I can, yeah.
Not that straight bros don't have really unique things to say if they find a point of view, but like as a overarching,
that it was dominant.
Dominance, the word. It was like this way or the highway. And like, I remember Susan Messing, who was an incredible teacher in Chicago. She was like, yeah, you just got to play with the boys, you know, like step up. And like, now I'm just like, thank God the BCC is like so queer friendly.
So everything friendly. So, I mean, I just think like in my little world, my life, I feel much more hopeful about how people relate and treat each other. I mean, I personally feel that way. I don't feel that way about necessarily society or the world or what's going on in the news and crap like that. But I do see, I do have some positive feelings about how things are going.
Yeah. And consciousness is, you know, Martin Luther King and justice, long arc of justice and bends upward over time. Things are a lot more open consciousness. Things have improved. I mean, even like gay rights, like in 20 years, it's incredible. And New York, I want to give a shout out to New York fucking city. Cause
totally.
I've lived here 10 years, had a love hate relationship with it. You know, what's the LA shitty heaven, New York's fun hell. But like, I love New York after lockdowns because I feel like people are really grateful to be here. They want to live their lives. Even if people are going to bed a little earlier, it's that there's much more of a vibe of like, we are in this together. And we're here to live and to be with each other and to, that's why I think comedy is live shows are important right now.
Yeah. Love seeing things live. So we've got just like 2 minutes left. So I want you to promote the BCC. And I want you to tell us, like, I want to come and see your show, Sparkle, and stuff like that. So tell us about BCC and tell us when we can see you.
Great.
Okay? You got a minute and a half. Go.
Okay. Our classes are year-round. They start up the next session. You can jump into a level one class, an improv, sketch, stand-up, clown, more, if that appeals to you, or just a one-day class. Our shows are Tuesday to Sunday nights at Aris. There's 24 shows a week. My show is the third Saturday. 24 shows. And there's an third Saturday of every month, Sparkle Hour. Come see me if you'd like. And then we have an open mic on Tuesdays and an improv jam on Tuesdays if you just want to come fuck around. If you're a corporation, hire us. We're really worth it. We'll change your lives. And then that's comedybrooklyn.com or at comedybrooklyn on the socials. And I'm at Philip Sparkle and philipsparkle.com. They both work if you want to check out my shit.
Wow, that's really good. You know, we could cut that out and make you a little commercial. That's that's a tight 30 seconds a minute. And I'm so glad you came in today. I really enjoyed our time.
I did too. And thank you for the questions. You were probing into things that I don't always talk about, or it was good when you called me back to something I skipped. Because I like to think that I'm an open book and can say anything, but there's always... I just believe we're always learning and we're always growing. And the second you stop learning and growing, your life gets pretty boring.
I'm 100% with you on that. So I just want to say to my listeners, thank you so much for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I'm here every Thursday, 2 to 3. I've got over 300 shows in my archive. You know, if you ever want to donate money, and let me know, I can give you a shout out. I started thinking, you know, I could be giving people shout outs about their shows. $5. You donate $5 and not to me, to the station. I will say something nice about you, or at least acknowledge you and, your show or your album or whatever. Okay. So you should stick around after this, because we've got so much great programming today. Thursday is a really, really great day here at Radio Free Brooklyn. Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit.